agriculturists, grass seed growers.
Oh, God.
Okay, I'd like to welcome everybody to the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. For the record, it is March 29th, 2011. We've got a large agenda today, and we've got a whole lot of people in the ag business here to talk about a few small little bills of people's interest. So here's what we're going to do. So a lot of you are not familiar with our process. I am going to introduce a legislative draft into the process, and the process on that, just so you know, is that it's a courtesy. Anyone can ask for a bill to be introduced, and we're going to be doing that. It doesn't commit the members to vote for it or anything. It just gets it going. Then I'm going to take up Senate Bill 904 and 935, which are fairly small and shouldn't take much time. And then we're going to move in and open on all four of the agricultural bills and hear from you. I will say that not one of the members of my committee has any experience in growing seed or selling seed or buying seed. We've been getting lots of calls from various parties, and as best I can tell, people are fairly have different opinions on those lists. So we're looking forward to being educated today. We will not act on the bills today, but we will hear, and hopefully in 2 hours we'll have enough time to hear it from everybody who wants. We not only have this room, but we have an overflow room going, so I hope people in the other room can see and hear the testimony. All right, so I'm going to start out then and open introduction of committee measures. Members, we have LC 3997, and the chair moves introduction of the legislative concept. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? There is none. We have introduced Legislative Council Draft 3997. Next, we will open on... Oh, and I should also note that it's my intent to... hopefully we'll get through this and to deal a work session on Senate Bill 438 when we're done with the seed drafts. Senate Bills 518, 725, and 877 we intend to carry over to our next meeting, which will be on Thursday. So we'll start out then. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 904. Richard.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 904 directs the Oregon Business Development Department to establish a program to allow rural airports in the state of Oregon to create airport tax increment financing districts. There is a revenue impact statement issued and a fiscal impact statement issued, and we've received pre-submitted testimony from Fred Nedler, president of Aurora Rural Fire Protection, in opposition to 904, and a letter from the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies in opposition to 904.
Okay, I guess I have five people signed up to speak on this. I'm going to ask you to come up in threes. Michael Novak, Mitch Swecker, ODA, and Mark Landauer. And after that, I've got Gary Oxley and Jerry Dale. Whoever wants to start.
Okay, very good. I'll be the first. Good afternoon, members of the committee. Mark Landauer with the Special Districts Association of Oregon, representing approximately 900 special districts across the state of Oregon, providing a variety of services to the citizens. SDO opposes Senate Bill 904, which would effectively allow the Oregon Business Development Department to create airport urban renewal districts. Over the years, as you know, special districts have had a number of concerns with urban renewal districts, and some of those concerns are actually contained within Senate Bill 904. Although the proposal in this case would give local taxing jurisdictions a say in whether they will rebate their property taxes for the purposes of tax increment funding, which is very distinct from traditional urban renewal, we are concerned that too little oversight or accountability for how that money will be spent is given to locally elected officials. Under the bill, an airport public-private committee would be established. Three-quarters of those members are not necessarily or would be public officials. Only one-fourth of the membership would be a public official. In fact, under the proposal, only cities or counties would be allowed to be a member of that oversight committee, which obviously has a great concern to special districts being effectively excluded from this oversight committee. Because many of our member districts rely solely on property taxes as a means to pay for services that are provided to their citizens, their ability to maintain existing service levels or increase service demands as a result of growth or what have you will be jeopardized as a result of this bill if it were enacted. We're also concerned that the proposal permits the use of these funds for non-property tax generating revenue. It will not necessarily result in an increase in value of property taxes because the bill would permit money to be spent for services, maintenance, things of that nature that don't necessarily result in an increase in value to the property tax. The bill is also flawed because it does not appear to make any mention of the county assessor, which plays a critical role in determining property values, also division of taxes, how much property tax increases have grown over the years, so on and so forth. So there's no real oversight as to whether or not the property taxes are being split in the proper manner. Due to the lack of this local oversight, exclusion of all taxing jurisdictions, being on the committee that has oversight to see how that money is expended, and that the allowable expenses do not necessarily generate increased property taxes, we are opposed to this measure, and thank you for the opportunity to be before you today.
Thank you, Mr. Landau. Or Mr. Novak.
Good afternoon, Michael Novak with the League of Oregon Cities, representing all 242 cities in the state of Oregon. I'll try not to reiterate too many of the points that Mr. Landauer mentioned. The League is opposed to Senate Bill 904. We have serious reservations regarding the use of this type of funding, this type of funding mechanism outside of urban renewal districts. Statutory authority already exists that would allow airports to work cooperatively with local governments to create a port district or an urban renewal district to assist in building out the types of infrastructure that's brought up in the bill. Additionally, 904 sets as Mr. Landauer said, it sets a dubious precedent by allowing tax increment financing to be used by the airports for operation, and maintenance, and service rather than limiting authority to capital construction. This is a significant deviation of a fundamental TIF practice, tax increment financing. The 904 sets up a misuse, if you will, of the TIF mechanism and is a poor choice when it appears there are other infrastructure funding options that already exist in the state. And finally, while the term urban renewal does not appear in this proposal, this does appear to be what's being created by the state at the local level, allowing an incursion of a state agency into local property tax authority. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Strucker.
For the record, my name is Mitch Swecker. I am the acting director of the Department of Aviation. I did submit a short written testimony. I will not go through that. I'm primarily here to answer questions that the committee may have, Mr. Chair.
You support it?
We are neutral on the bill.
Any questions of this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. Gary Oxley and Aaron Baker. Mr. Oxley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Gary Oxley, Oxley & Associates, appearing before you this afternoon on behalf of the Oregon Aviation Business Association. With me is Aaron Fagery, who is the volunteer executive director of the association. And just to give you a brief background, the Aviation Association is comprised of a consortium of individual business owners and operators whose businesses are aviation related. This bill is a bill that was initially introduced in the EO 7 session, and we tabled it due to some questions arising regarding the implementation and how it would work. Senator Starr subsequently put together a stakeholders group, and that group created what you have before you today. And it's important to recognize that while you have heard a number of issues presented by local governments, that this bill would not be implemented, and the guidelines under this bill would not be implemented without the full support, approval, and conditions of all of the local governments and service districts. So having said that, I'll ask Aaron to go into in-depth detail about what the bill does.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for having us here today.
Could you put your name on the record, please?
Aaron Fagry, 520 Southwest Yamhill Street, Portland, 97204. I'm an architect and engineer specializing in aviation planning, have worked on roughly 30 airports all over the state, and during a career of roughly 25 years so far working on these various airports. One of the things that I discovered in my work was that the rural airports were capable of creating jobs and being kind of technology centers in our rural areas, but weren't functioning that way in some ways because of the need for an airport to be out in a rural area so that noise doesn't bother people in the urban area, yet it needs sewer and water and funding to create roads and different things. The FAA funds most of what we get at our airports, but it does not fund things like fire protection or utilities, roads, kind of the essential infrastructure. As an architect, I work on projects which use the TIF method, and so I was aware of it. I knew of some other states that were attempting to kind of develop public-private partnerships, and in Oregon, several of us then put together efforts to try to accomplish this, and the Aurora Airport has been kind of the poster child for the success of getting the public and the private to work together, and it to this point has created something on the order of 750 jobs, and is even attracting right now. We're building a new facility for a Canadian company that is basing here in Oregon, bringing their jobs here permanently and putting their facility on the tax rolls. One of the biggest problems at these airports is infrastructure that the FAA doesn't fund. And I know you have a letter from the Aurora Fire District, and we work very closely with those folks and know them very well. One thing that they might not have thought about is that they might well be the successful partner in one of these programs. And in fact, they have a fire truck that was donated to them that's sitting on the airport without a garage. There's no money to build that garage, and that's just the kind of thing that this program is intended to allow to happen or to promote to happen, provide funds for. One thing that's important to realize is many of Oregon's airports do not pay any substantial taxes right now because there is an exception in the tax code for small airports under certain conditions, and many of them follow that. In putting this bill together, we wanted to make airports a closer part of the community and felt that the concept of a rising tide can lift all boats, that through something like this, then there is some reward coming back to the taxing districts immediately as new properties can be developed because of the need for the infrastructure. We also tried to put it in a form where it only can occur where the local agencies and the taxing districts all agree on it. And so it requires a kind of an exceptional level of community agreement. So I think For example, with the Aurora Fire District letter, if they were going to object to it, they wouldn't happen. But there are small communities out there, and I've worked very closely with Baker City as an example, and I have given you a letter. They're very interested in that concept. And for example, they don't have fire water, and potentially they can't build a single hangar out there right now under the current building code. And so that's the kind of dilemma we have at these airports. This bill is intended to create at least a tool that might work for some of those airports. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Let's see. Jerry Dale, Ted Millar, and Ed Freeman. Whenever you're ready.
My name's Ted Millar. I own South End Air Park at the Aurora Airport. We've been in the development business in Oregon for 53 years, and we've been very active in bringing new businesses to the airport. And this bill is all about jobs. The airport supports a lot of the surrounding businesses around the Wilsonville-Cambie area. And because the FAA pays for a lot of the basic improvements, the things like the road improvements around it, the fire water, sewer, those kind of facilities have no way of being funded. And so this bill would allow funding for those uses. It's a very important part of it.
Thank you, sir. Yes, my name is Jerry Dale. I'm from Newburgh, and my family own and operate Sportsman Air Park there. It's a privately owned public use airport that's been there for some 60-odd years now. And I'll be short and sweet about this and, you know, not take up time, but we think this is a good program that will allow especially smaller airports and especially ones that are not eligible for federal funding to help finance some infrastructure for the airports. And it's we look at it as a win-win. The bill is forcing any jurisdiction anywhere to do anything. It takes consensus among all the taxing districts, and if people are willing to do that and get some economic activity and jobs going, then we think that's a good deal. I have a letter that I've presented, and I'll pass out to each one. So,
thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Ed Freeman, and along with my partner Joseph Weston, we own several hundred acres in Columbia County at the Scappoose Airport. We're very interested in supporting this bill. We feel it. Job creation in Columbia County, as it is at many of the rural airports around the state, are in some of the hardest hit counties as far as unemployment is concerned. And we intend to develop our property as industrial, airport-related industrial, whereby we can attract businesses from out of state and grow the local-based companies in the aviation cluster. The infrastructure costs are tremendous, and we feel that this bill would help promote the jobs and the development of these properties, as you can and well imagine. So I just would appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of this panel?
One quick question.
Senator Atkinson.
Mr. Dale, this is off topic to the bill, but my son and I were trying to determine how long is your airstrip?
It's 2,755 feet.
Thank you. I feel much better now. 2750. Thank you. Just looks a little nervous getting in there, but I haven't flown in. Thank you very much.
I'd be happy to give you some instruction to in and out if you
thank
like.
Thank you. I'll need it. I'll call you if I do.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. That's all I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 904? Seeing none, I'm going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 904 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 935. Senator Devlin.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, you may recall that I've been doing a few presentations today, so I'm maybe not on my A game at this point. But I'm here to speak about Senate Bill 935. I very much appreciate the chair hearing this bill and the committee being here to hear this bill. Before I go into the bill in detail, I might tell you just a little bit of background. There are big bills in this building, there are medium bills in this building, and there are small bills in this building. This is a small bill that will help a few people. Senator Starr perhaps doesn't know this, but we share something in common. Senator Starr, former Senator Starr, his dad, was a roofing contractor and actually farmer also. My father, who, if he was alive now, would be turning 101 years old, was a remodeling contractor and painting contractor. Senate Bill 935 deals with some issues that are unfortunate issues that we deal with now in our economy. Our economic conditions are relatively severe. This bill will provide some Oregonians with the necessary tools to get back on their feet and back in business. In 2010, the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Columbia received 20,243 bankruptcy petitions. This equals approximately one petition for every 190 Oregonians in the state. This bill is going to help a few people potentially return to being economically viable. As we know, one of the hardest hit areas in our economy is construction. We also know that many people, as part of their trade or other involvement, have tools that they have to purchase, tools that allow them to continue in their profession. By increasing the tools of the trade exemption from $3,000 to $5,000 per person, we will at least provide a few more Oregonians with the opportunity for a fresh start while ensuring the creditors are still able to collect the necessary assets. I became involved in this issue when a constituent contacted me back in January. She had recently declared personal bankruptcy after the small business that she and her husband had started failed. As part of the bankruptcy process, my constituent had to sell off some of the tools of her trade, in this case, video equipment. This left them with a limited amount of assets to return to the workforce in the area in which they were skilled. As you may know, and I'll give you just a little bit of background here, which I think you already know, but it's part of my testimony, is bankruptcy is governed by federal law. Under federal bankruptcy code, a debtor is allowed to hold back some property from the claims of creditors through the exemption process. There are a number of federal exemptions which can protect a debtor's home, vehicle, personal property, domestic animals and poultry, firearms, clothing and jewelry, and of course, tools of the trade. In addition, the federal code permits each state to adopt its own exemption laws in place of the federal exemptions. Oregon has chosen to utilize its own state-specific exemptions rather than follow the federal exemption amounts. This includes the tools of the trade exemption. In Oregon, the tools of the trade refers to any tools, apparatus, implements, team, harness, or library that a debtor would use to carry on their trade, occupation, or profession. This limit was at last increased in 1993, almost 20 years ago, and this bill basically would increase it from $3,000 to $5,000. Compared to some of our other western states, Washington provides a $5,000 exemption in this area, California a $6,075 exemption in this area. I have had discussions with all of the lobby, the United Financial Lobby. There is no opposition to this bill. In fact, this bill was purposely drafted in such a way that the relating clause can be not tampered with. It can only be for tools of the trade and cannot be opened up for other exemptions to modify them at this time. This is a small bill, but I do believe, quite honestly, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that it will help a few Oregonians get back on their feet, particularly Oregonians with skills that we will need in the future. And this may just give them that one sort of hand up, not a handout.
Any questions for Senator Edelman? Thank you, Senator. Appreciate you bringing this bill. I have two people signed up on this, and I'm not going to try your last names. We'll see if I can get you Todd and Aaron.
That's by Todd Brodyard.
Okay. Well,
thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. My name is Todd Schreweiler. I've been a bankruptcy attorney for about 26 years. We're Oregon and Southwest Washington's largest bankruptcy firm, and I've done over 30,000 bankruptcies. In the last 3 or 4 years, bankruptcy has become an epidemic. And a big problem we see is in the construction trade, in the roofing trade, in the automotive trades, we've seen a lot of people laid off. And most of these people, rather than going on unemployment, have opted to start their own businesses. Now, the problem is tools of the trades are very expensive. Snap-on tools, if you're an automotive dealer or repair person, is very expensive. And if that person runs into a problem, if they later need to file bankruptcy, those tools can be taken away if their value is more than $3,000. So the real problem these people are facing is it's a down economy. They've usually used their pension money or their final savings to get into business. And now the problem is if they run into rough times again while they're self-employed, they can lose that business because they lose the tools to make it work. A day doesn't go by. We get 400 to 500 calls a month. And a day doesn't go by when we don't have at least one person who's self-employed with tools. And often I've got to tell them, you may not qualify for a Chapter 7 bankruptcy because you're putting your earnings at risk. If you file, the court can take those tools, sell them, and pay to your creditors, which quite often is a de minimis payment because they might have $50,000, $100,000 worth of debt, and $3,000 or $4,000 worth of tools gives a very small and significant portion to each creditor. So I'm in support of Bill 935, and I think it makes a lot of sense, and I think it keeps a lot of people from the unemployment ranks.
Thank you, sir.
My name is Aaron Rabroff. I'm the attorney in residence in Eugene for Olson and Daines. We primarily do bankruptcy and are among the largest in the state as well. I have written testimony. I'll try not to repeat that. I just want to highlight our last night while preparing, I asked some of the other attorneys, and I went through my files myself to try to find stories that are kind of indicative of how this affects people. I want to just share briefly two of those. One was an auto mechanic for a dealership in Portland. Over the years, invested in his work. He felt he did a job and he wanted to improve it, and he bought quite a few Snap-on tools, which are fairly high quality. When he came to see us at the consultation, it became clear he had at least $6,000 worth of Snap-on tools. It was left him in a rather difficult position that to take care of his debt, to get a fresh start, he was looking at losing about half of the tools he needed to do his business, either by selling them before he filed or letting the trustee sell them for him. Similarly, I have another story I want to share from a client we had in Roseburg. He actually had a full-time job, but because he had 5 children, he supplemented his income working nights and weekends, working a portable sawmill he had bought with a small inheritance. He eventually lost that full-time job. The sawmill became his only source of income for the whole family. When he came to see us, it became clear the sawmill was probably going to be worth about $5,000 to $10,000. The only real way that was viable for him to get creditors from hounding him and to give him a fresh start was to do a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, but to do so essentially would eliminate the only source he had to support his family. $5,000 is a very modest sum still. In these difficult times, it's not going to make a very big difference for most of these large creditors, but it makes a world of difference for people looking to start over and be able to still contribute to the economy after they've been given a new start.
Thank you. Any questions at this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 935? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 935. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2159 and Senate Bills 788, 789, and 790. Let's see. We have a lot of people who want to testify. I think we'll start out with the department. So let's have Lisa Hansen and Jim Kramer. And after that, Mark Simmons and Roger Beyer.
Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Thank you for the opportunity to come and visit with you about one of our agency bills. This is probably one of the smaller bills that you'll hear today that deals with issues relating to the Oregon grass seed industry. 2159 specifically deals with a section of the law that ODA administers that is commonly referred to as the slow pay, no pay law. Simply, this section of the law authorizes ODA to work to resolve payment issues between grass seed growers and grass seed dealers. It was implemented by the legislature back in 2001 following a major bankruptcy of a large seed company in Oregon where many growers were left without payment for their seed production. The bill, 2159, does three major things in terms of modifying the slow pay, no pay law. And these are issues that have come up as we've been administering it over about the last decade. It adds the type, an additional type of contract that is commonly used within the seed industry. So currently the law says that we can work with contracts that address acres of production. This allows us to work with production contracts that are for pounds of production. We have had situations where the grower contracts were written differently than what is specified in the law, and that has made them exempt from our services. Secondly, it allows the Department of Agriculture by administrative rule to expand the types of seeds that are covered under the slow pay, no pay law. Currently, slow pay, no pay addresses grass seed and clover seed. So if at the request of the seed industry, additional types of seeds could be added, such as vegetable seeds or flower seeds, so that those contracts would be considered as well. And then finally, probably one of the largest changes that's proposed in House Bill 2159 is it modifies the definition of what a wholesale seed dealer is. Currently, it's someone who sells or offers for sale grass seed or seed in the state. This would include people who contract for seed in the state. So it would allow us the ability to take action for those seed companies that are out of state that contract for production within Oregon. And then finally, there are some small harmonization changes that are proposed to the seed law that include flower seeds in a couple of areas where it currently looks at grass seed, agricultural seed, and vegetable seeds. So with that, we would be happy to answer questions to walk you through the bill, or Jim Kramer can specifically speak to some of the experiences that we've had administering the slow pay, no pay law.
So the depth of the remedy that the department has is to pull a license?
For the record, Jim Kramer, Administrator of the Commodity Inspection Division, Oregon Department of Ag. Chair Byer, basically the end zone with house with the slow pay, no pay is the suspension of a license.
You can't force them to pay up on the contract or settle disputes. It's just pull the license.
No, Chair Byer, if actually that's the end of it. If there was actually any financial remedy, they'd still have to take that civilly.
Okay. Fair enough.
Can I follow up? I think just for more clarification around your question.
Okay.
The slow pay, no pay is a little bit like progressive discipline. It allows ODA to initially go in, evaluate the contracts, make contact with the seed dealers, put out a letter of demand for payment, and then ultimately, if the contracts are not taken care of, then the ultimate action would be the suspension of a license. So just to give you a sense for how we move along that progressive line.
Okay. Questions? Thank you. Excuse me.
Thank you.
Senator Starr.
I understand you're here to testify on the department's bills, but we've opened a hearing on several other bills. And I think I would be interested in your perspective on these other bills as well. And if you're not prepared to testify right this moment, I'd appreciate that. But at some point, would very much appreciate you weighing in on those other bills.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, thank you for that. We aren't prepared to testify on all the bills today. The department hasn't taken positions on the bills, but we'll be happy to provide you any background information of how it impacts the programs administered within ODA, ultimately, as you move through this process and questions may come up.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Let's see, Mr. Beyer, Mr. Simmons. Mr. Simmons, why don't you start, since you were the author of the other three bills?
Old Home Week.
Old Home Week, yeah.
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Mark Simmons. I am here as the Executive Director for the Oregon Grass Seed Bargaining Association. I want to especially thank Senator Atkinson, your Vice Chair, for his generosity in sponsoring these bills and allowing us access to this process. Thank you very much. I am not the author of these bills, but I am the staff of a work group, an ad hoc group of folks who put these bills together. You know, over the years, the grass seed industry has evolved from a situation where dealers and growers held equal power in their relationship to one today that has primarily proprietary varieties that are grown by growers. The seed, even the plant in the field, the grass plant, is actually owned by the dealer. The seed that's produced is owned by the dealer, and the grower provides his land, his equipment, his services to produce seed for the dealer. The situation that's before us today is actually unsustainable for the seed industry without a significant rebound. The issues that this legislation addresses are not new. They've been around for a long time. In fact, there was a work group formed in the fall of 2008 to pull together some legislation for the 2009 session, and the then president of the Oregon Seed Trade Association discouraged the effort, said, listen, let's talk about that during the interim between the sessions and try to resolve some of this, but no action was taken. So seed dealer reluctance to deal with these issues is not new. So we announced, the Oregon Grass Seed Bargaining Association announced last spring in our newsletter that we would be taking these issues up to be brought before the 2011 legislature. We distributed those newsletters at the Oregon Seed Trade Association annual meeting and have been talking about it in our newsletters ever since. And in the late summer, we formed a committee. It includes two dealers. Mike Baker from Pennington, he's one of the most respected voices in the seed industry in Oregon. Brett Freeborn from Mountain View Seed, one of the other big seed companies in the state. Three growers, Kevin Dorfer from the Foothills over here, Ron Quarian from Riprial, and Matt Crocker from the South Valley. We needed a banker. I wanted a banker on this committee. So he understands how the money flows. He finances both dealers and growers. And it was important, I thought, to have that perspective. So Bob Boyle, who manages Farm Credit for Oregon and Washington, volunteered to be on the committee. We have our legal counsel from the association. The Oregon Department of Ag came and participated so that we could craft good policy, and we worked very hard to produce legislation that would benefit the entire industry and would have little or no impact on the good ethical dealers but make the bad actors improve their game. And I believe that we have for the most part succeeded. We modeled what we've produced after the statutes currently on the books in Washington, Idaho, and Minnesota, and then we made every effort to make it public. We presented it to the Oregon Seed Trade Association at their winter meeting and to the Seed Council and to many others since then. Matter of fact, when I talk to growers, they say, you know, you've compromised too much. We should have payment from dealers 30 days after I present him with a test showing the seed I produced meets the quality he asked me to produce. Well, we aren't asking for that here. We've compromised a lot. We're asking that we get paid by May 1 of the year following harvest. That's 10 months after harvest. We're asking that the dealers, that growers be paid by the dealers for the seed they have produced. And this legislation, we're actually on the fifth version. You'll see a 790-5, That is the bill that we are talking about here today. We have taken a lot of input from a lot of people and crafted the language that you have before you today. And what it does simply, it encourages that we get our contracts before the seed is planted. That's a novel concept, isn't it? We ought to get a contract before the seed is planted. It requires that we get paid for the seed we have produced by May 1 of the year following harvest, 10 months after harvest, and that we deal with storage. That's what it requires. And we did that in two sections, because freedom of contract really only exists when both parties are equally situated in a relationship. And that is most often found in the seed industry when the dealer and grower before seed has been planted. Once the grower has planted the seed, he's over a barrel. He's committed. He's on the hook. And he's in a much weaker place to negotiate with a dealer over terms of a contract when he's already planted the seed. So we do this in two sections. If you want to agree, if you get a contract out to a grower before seed is planted, you can agree to pretty much anything you want. Even some of these contracts that say price will be determined by the dealer. And then we encourage you to deal with storage. We say unless otherwise provided in the contract, the responsibility for storage will shift to the dealer when the grower presents him with a test showing he met the specifications of the contract. There's a problem with that in current law. The slow pay, no pay law, the folks from the Department of Ag were just talking about, they cannot enforce contracts that say price will be determined by dealer. There's a lot of contracts out there today that say the price of seed that we pay you, we will determine it as a dealer, and you'll take the price we decide to give you when it's time to settle the contract. The Department of Justice has told the Department of Ag that these contracts are not enforceable and stay out of them. So what we've done is referred to the Uniform Commercial Code. It's a body of law that's been in place since 1962 and regulated contracts among most segments of business. It requires that you essentially reach an objectively reasonable price for the seed that has been produced in this case. And we include that by reference. So if a grower and dealer have negotiated, come to an agreement on a contract that says price will be determined by dealer, there's a remedy there if he gets into a slow pay, no pay claim, or the two of them have a dispute over the price. So that's all the limitation there is on contracts. Now, if a contract is not received by the grower until after the seed is planted, we go a little bit further. We make the storage provision mandatory. We say the dealer will pay for storage once the grower has presented him with a test showing that the seed grown meets the requirements in the contract. And we say you need to pay the grower by May 1 of the year following harvest. Then for cases where there is a dispute over quality.
Senator Stark, yeah, can I ask a question right now?
Yeah.
You just brought up that term about the meeting the requirements of the test of the seed. Is there anything in these bills that deal with how those tests are administered? Because my understanding is that you've got some dealers that use certain tests and others, and the fluorescence and, you know, the grow and all that stuff. These bills don't deal with that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, no. We leave that to discretion of the dealer and grower, and you're exactly right. The very astute of you, there are all kinds of tests, fluorescence tests, grow-out tests.
Isn't that one of the ways, though, that the dealers then try to renege on a deal with a grower?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, there is certainly a perception among some growers that is indeed the case. As supplies have been long and markets have been shorter, you've seen the quality specs really tighten up, where when the market is flowing better and seed is moving better, dealers are willing to take seed that doesn't meet those kind of standards.
Yes, thank you for allowing me to ask the question.
I'm following up on that myself. Aren't the standards established at the front end in a contract or a marketing agreement?
Senator, Chair Beyer, yes, if the contract is in fact delivered and signed at the front end of the agreement, yes, you're right. And that is one of the problems we're trying to address.
Okay, so a lot of these deals, handshakes?
Some of these deals are indeed handshakes. Other times there's representations, that, as you will hear from testimony, that a contractor will be forthcoming at some time, but sometimes it's 6 months, 8 months, a long time before a grower actually sees the contract.
Sometimes the code of the West doesn't work. I'm sorry. Continue, please.
Okay, we are talking about a provision to enable the grower to turn that seed into cash. As Senator Starr alluded to, there are differences in seed testing. Those tests can show different results for the same lot of seed. Sometimes a fluorescence test shows that your seed just barely missed the requirements of the contract, where a grow-out test will show that you met it quite handily. What we've done here is said, okay, if there's a dispute ongoing between the dealer and the grower, on May 1 of the year following harvest, they haven't settled it yet, the grower can send a letter to the dealer and say, release the seed so I can either come buy it at a price we will agree to, or release the seed so I can go sell it, turn it into cash, and get on with my life. That is pretty reasonable. Matter of fact, all these provisions, I believe, are quite reasonable. I wouldn't be advocating for them here, I suppose, if I didn't. So Senate Bill 790 simply says, get us a contract before we plant. It encourages you to, the dealer. If you don't get it till after we planted, we provide a few sideboards in there that are not prohibitive. Pay us a fair price by May 1 of the year following harvest, and then deal with storage of the seed. And that is essentially Senate Bill 790. Mr. Chair, do you want to go on through the others, or would you prefer to let Senator,
Well, I want to make
Roger
sure
Beyer,
that you have
Mr.
covered
Beyer.
The bill, that the bills that you introduced, had introduced, so that we start off as a framework. Have you done that?
No. I've only covered Senate Bill 790.
Is it your intent that 788 and 789 would also move?
Yes, sir.
Then you better cover them, too.
Okay. Senate Bill 789 is a dealer bond. Currently, to be a dealer in Oregon, you buy a $450 seed dealer license, and you are, in fact, a dealer. To be a grower, you have to have a huge investment in equipment, in land, know-how, and it costs a great deal to grow the seed, the inputs, the fuel, labor, land rent, time, energy, and expense of producing seed. There are growers who will plant this spring, tall fescue, for example, and they won't have any opportunity to get any income from that until spring of 2013, May, if it takes that long. This bill is simply a minimal assurance of financial responsibility on behalf of the dealer. It requires dealers to carry a bond. The bond requirement is half, approximately, maybe even less, of what dealers are required to carry currently in Washington or Idaho. So it's not an overreach. It's a modest bond. It encourages dealers to be responsible for the contracts they place with growers, and we believe it will serve as a canary in the coal mine, if you will. And if a dealer is getting into trouble, it will provide an early warning signal that will allow growers to protect themselves if a dealer is beginning to get into trouble. So that is essentially 789. There is an amendment, a -1 amendment to Senate Bill 789 that makes a few minor adjustments to the bill. Dealer information submitted to the Department of Ag will be confidential. Some information submitted to help the Department of Ag determine their bond amount will be confidential. It adjusts the bond schedule and requires that the Department of Ag manage bond claims against a dealer's bond. We don't want to see a lot of frivolous bond claims thrown against the wall against dealers. And then we have Senate Bill 788. And Senate Bill 788 is a simple and straightforward bill. In 1922, Congress passed the Capra-Volstead Act. The Capra-Volstead Act gives growers the authority to come together as a group and negotiate as a group with those who purchase their products. The problem is, if those who purchase their products don't participate, they can effectively take that right away from the growers. So Minnesota and Washington dealt with that problem by passing a law that allows bargaining associations to be accredited. And that simply means the bargaining association will submit their list of members to the Department of Agriculture. They'll review that list, make sure that it is in fact all growers who grow the products they want to negotiate over. And once they have been, and then accredit the bargaining association. And once that has happened, when it's time to negotiate, it becomes an unfair practice for dealers not to participate. That's all it does. It does not require agreement. It only requires good faith negotiation. It does not include mediation or arbitration, although that could be considered in rule. And so it simply says we're going to talk and we're all going to participate. In 1999, there was litigation between several members of the seed industry in Oregon, businesses, dealers, and the bargaining association. And the result of that litigation in Judge Hogan's court was the supervised bargaining statutes that we have on the books in Oregon that allows dealers to come together as a group with growers, and the dealers can talk about price under the supervision of the Department of Ag and then negotiate with the growers. That was the nexus. That litigation was the nexus of that law. It's the only one like it in the nation. The problem is that since that time, only the first year only, the Oregon Seed Trade Association, since then, has not appointed a committee to come together and negotiate with the growers. They've walked away from their side of the agreement. And we would like to see that change. We would like to see a healthy relationship between dealers and growers and the bargaining association. And so we brought you Senate Bill 788.
Any questions of Mark? Thank you. Roger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Seed Council. The Oregon Seed Council, just for your reference, is an association that includes all parties in the seed industry. That by all parties, I mean we have growers, we have dealers, we have affiliated industries like the straw balers, the feed and grain folks, the turf grass breeders, and also the state agencies and OSU as advisory members. So we try to represent everyone in the industry, and we try to work toward areas of agreement whenever we can on issues dealing with grass and legume seeds. I will start my testimony to talk about House Bill 2159. House Bill 2159 is a product of the Oregon Seed Council Legislative Committee. You heard Mr. Simmons reference a bill that was proposed for the 09 session that was pulled back and that didn't go anywhere. My president of the Oregon Seed Council at that time appointed a legislative committee to try to work on this issue and work toward agreement on the issue. What you have in House Bill 2159 is the product of that agreement that was reached by the Oregon Seed Council Legislative Committee. A modest bill, I will admit to that, but it does make some important changes. It should make the process work better in the slow pay, no pay world. I will next, and the Seed Council fully supports that bill as drafted. I will next go to Senate Bill 789. Senate Bill 789 that you've heard described by Mr. Simmons. The Oregon Seed Council has looked at this issue multiple times at its most recent meeting. A decision was made to support the concept in the bill with some fairly significant changes. You have in front of you a -2 amendment to Senate Bill 789. That amendment reflects most of those changes. As I was going through the amendment, I see there were some things left out of it that we'll have to work on to get corrected. Some very, very technical things, but I want to make sure I point those out because without those provisions, my board would not have endorsed this bill. So basically, the first one, in addition to what you have heard Mr. Simmons describe, we believe this bill should be on, we should not include clover seed or other types of seed, only grass seed. So the production contracts that are used to determine the level of bonding should only be based on grass seed, not other types of seed, and only grass seed producers on grass seed contracts would be able to claim against the bond. that in the two amendments is in Section 3 and in Section 4, Sub 4. We believe this bill should have a first strike provision. In Section 4 of the bill, you will see that a grass seed dealer would only be required to get a bond after they've had a valid claim against them in the slow pay, no pay process. Prior to that, the dealers would not be required to post a bond. Once they've had that claim against them, from that point in time on, they would be required to get a bond in order to renew their license. That would be a way to get to the bad actors, as we've heard about in the industry. There are two other things that are not in the bill that I had hoped would be in this draft, or excuse me, in this amendment, that I need to point out that are very important. One would be, we believe that the grower should have, there should be a fee to access the services of the Department of Ag and institute a claim against bond. A very nominal fee for a first look, less than $50, as I anticipated it would be, a fee not to exceed $50 for a review of a contract, or, you know, kind of a, the department describes their services being sidewalk attorneys. I guess have the growers pay for that service. The other thing then, if they want to initiate a claim against the bond after they've determined the department, you know, comes back and says, yes, you know, we believe you have a valid claim, there'd be another fee. We believe it should be not to exceed $200 to initiate a claim against the bond. I guess, for lack of a better way to put it, but have the growers have some skin in the game also. And finally, another thing that's not in this amendment that we believe should be in the amendment is the grower should have to demonstrate a proof of an attempt to collect from the seed dealer. That proof could be something as simple as an invoice. They send an invoice to the dealer for the for their seed. So with those changes, Oregon Seed Council would support the Senate Bill 789-2 amendments with those three additional changes I just described. Very briefly then, trying to be concerned about the time you have for the hearing, I'll try to go over the Dash 4 amendments. Again, the Oregon Seed Council, at its most recent meeting, has voted to approve Senate Bill 790 with the Dash 4 amendments. There are some significant differences between the Dash 4 amendments and what you just heard Mr. Simmons describe. I will try to briefly go through those. The first and probably most important change is under the bill as drafted, or one of the Dash 2, 5, one of the other dashes. I'm not sure which one we're on right now. But under that one, the May 1st deadline for the year following harvest is a hard and fast deadline. No grass seed contract would be able to have final payment after May 1st. What my board voted to support was a bill that would allow a softening, if you would, of that May 1st deadline, providing that at least 40% of the value of the contract has been paid to the grower by March 15th. So in that scenario, as long as the contract had a term that said 40% will be received by March 15th, they could use a date beyond May 1st as a final payment date.
Senator Atkinson.
Can I ask you a quick question about that? Is the softening of that deadline for tax purposes or for cash flow purposes or both?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, the softening of that deadline is an attempt to recognize that in this industry, sometime folks like to make deals for tax purposes. Maybe they want to just make sure they're getting paid for their production costs. You know, they got fertilizer bills, they got spray bills due by about the middle of March. They'd like to have some money by then, but they might can wait, you know, for the rest of it. In a downturn in the industry, we don't want the dealers to have to be, you know, potentially be forced to make payments on May 15th if there's a seed that was going to plug the pipeline, so to speak. So there's a multiple reasons to ask for a softening of that date, but that is a key difference between these two versions of the bill.
It's sort of like, who do you want to carry the burden?
Mr. Chair,
who wants to play bank? Huh?
My association represents the entire grass seed industry. Another key difference in the bill is in Section 3, the default contract section. Under the version that Mr. Simmons spoke to, there are a couple changes here that we have asked or we would like to see included. One being that if the two grower-dealer don't have a contract at the time of planting, but at a later date can reach a contract,
whether it's better or worse than what the terms of the bill are, we believe they should be able to do that. Two people should be able to contract if, you know, the. So we allow that for that to happen in this version. So there would be an opportunity for an agreement outside the details of this bill. Recognizing that under that, the 40% by March 15th is not an option. That has to happen no matter what. But the other things on storage, on other provisions, on testing, things like that, if they can come to agreements, let them come to agreements. The other major difference in Section 3 is that under the other version, the grower has to wait until May 1st to then get his what's known as VNS, variety not stated, seed, which is the seed that doesn't meet quality standards. They have to wait until May 1st to get that release from the dealer. We believe that could create a bottleneck and a quite frankly a pile of seed on June 1st, because if there's a whole bunch of VNS seeds sitting around waiting until May 1st, then the growers are either going to get it all released at the same time. We believe that it should, and as this version says, that at any time after seed testing, the grower sends the dealer a letter stating that I have this lot of seed that I grew for you that does not meet your quality standards in your contract. You have 30 days to respond to me to say you want the seed under the terms of the contract, and if you don't respond, then I can sell it at any time from then on. So they don't have to pay for it 30 days after the letter, but they have to agree to buy it at the contracted terms. That there are two other differences. One, again, we believe that the grower should have to pay for services at the Department of Ag, both for the sidewalk attorney services and to institute a slow pay, no pay claim. And I've got to look at my cheat sheet to find out what the other one, because there's one more difference. Okay. Look in the other bill file for just a second. Oh, the other difference is that this contracting bill also should only apply to grass seed, not other types of seed. With that, Mr. Chair, I have no comments to make on Senate Bill 788. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questioner. Senator Starr.
So your association is not taking a position on 788?
That's correct.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
All right, I'm now going to move, and I've got sign-ups on four different sheets, so I'm just going to start out the top one on each with one exception. We have a rule that says anybody who lives 100 miles away goes first. Make sure they get a chance. So I have Bill Marion?
He should be hearing us.
Okay, Bill, if you're in the overflow and hear this, why don't you come on in, and I'm going to go ahead and I'll start with Ron Kewing. Not ask, keep in mind that this committee knows very little about the business, so I appreciate if you just make sure whether you let us know where you stand on the bills, support or oppose them, and what your major concerns are, and we've got a lot of people, so please try not to be redundant and keep it quick.
Okay.
But take the time you need.
Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead.
My name's Ron Quering. I'm a grower in Rickreal. I've been part of this, we call it a profitability committee that Mark referred to that put this thing together. But I also have a personal story that kind of, where the remedy is trying to seek is what I guess I'm trying to say. But let me preface this these few words with the fact that not all dealers and growers are at odds with each other. I mean, that's typically not the case. This is, in most contracts, grower and dealer relationships are very good. But in the past, there's been very little recourse for growers to arbitrate with a dealer that he feels like he has been taken advantage of. So may I share with you one example of what can go wrong. Prior to 2008, a dealer, let's call him Dealer A, came to our family farm and asked us to grow proprietary tall fescue. That means a variety that he owned and was marketing on his own. At the time, we did not know who owned the variety or that this seed dealer was acting as a broker to find growers for another seed dealer we'll call seed dealer B. So the contract with the dealer A, the broker, was signed, and the seed went into the ground. And in those days, payment was received, movement was good, and we had been shipping in the fall for a couple of years. Payment was received from dealer A, most of the time, right on time. The price agreement in this contract was set on two call dates. Typically, in this kind of a contract, we just pick like July 15th, and what's the market price, and then September 15th. And then we take the average of those two, what the dealer would call average market price, and that's what we would settle on for the price. So came the fall of 2008, and the average price for the call dates was given at 68 cents a pound. Fall came and went. Then winter and early spring came and went, and still none of that seed had moved and no payment had been received. We had been communicating with dealer A, the broker, through which the contract was written, throughout the winter as to when shipment and payment might be made. Dealer A, because he had no control over the sale of the crop, has no idea about these things and when it might happen. At this point, we see the real problem we've gotten ourselves into by not dealing directly with the owner of the seed. Finally, after May 1, the following year, an offer is made on our seed for 50 cents per pound. This was 9 months after we had had the seed harvested and more than 18 months from when we had began input costs. Finally, we settled on 54 cents per pound, but that is not what the contract dictated, and we needed to get some money out of the crop. Not knowing that we were going to be taken to the cleaners in the fall of 2008, the tall fescue fields remained in for the crop of 2009. And once again, we were up against the issue of shipment and payment for that 2009 crop. We are currently still holding that crop, because dealer B will not honor the contract, which states that the minimum price will be 40 cents per pound. As a result, we've been the bankers for dealer B going on 2 years with little hope for a near future. And by the way, he still has his business in Lake Oswego, and he still enjoys his vacation home in Bend. What is our recourse? We could ask dealer B to release the seed to us so we could sell it without a variety name on it, like this VNS. But why should that be my problem? It's his seed. An honest dealer would pay his debts and move on, and the other companies that we have done business with have done that. Or I could have taken my case to the Department of Ag in Salem, and with them, maybe I could have gotten some money out of dealer A, the broker, but he doesn't have the kind of cash to pay off dealer B's debts. Or why should he? According to the slow pay law, the department could suspend dealer A's license, that broker, in which case I still wouldn't get any cash, and neither would any other grower that had a grass contract with that dealer, or any other kind as far as that's concerned. So why would I want to do that? Besides, he's not the problem. These bills would address a number of issues that we're going through. First, Section 6 of Bill 790 holds the parent company responsible, even if they use a second company to place acres or deal with growers. Second, in our case, we have been storing dealer B's seed, in which he has paid no storage, no interest, or any kind of remuneration for his unethical conduct. Under Section 3 of Bill 790, the issue of storage is addressed for seed meeting the contract standards. Thirdly, when there is a disagreement about the terms of the contract, the grower has some recourse in Bill 789 to at least call the bond of the dealer for lack of payment or a price dispute. Along with the fact that Section 4 in Senate Bill 790, a grower cannot be forced to modify the contract, modify an existing contract, which is basically what we're saying, is that we're not going to try to go renegotiate a price. We got a price. Let's live by it. I know this is long and tedious and detailed work, but I feel like finally there is some hope in balancing the grower and dealer framework for grass seed in Oregon. We may never see the seed market come back to what it was, but there must be more balanced approach to grass seed production rather than on the backs of the grass seed grower. This process has taken place over many months, and it's very divisive. You will have dealers here that are in support of this effort because they realize they need to build lasting relationship with growers to get a consistent supply of seed. And then you will have dealers that believe that growers are just serfs. Once they have had the seed in the ground, they can change the contract, delay shipping, delay payments, and continue to take advantage of any grower unlucky enough or desperate enough to grow for them. This bill has to come from the growers themselves. If you were to ask the dealer if some correction were needed in the industry, most would agree. But they could never agree to put anything forward. This is why, as growers, we have brought these bills to you this year. It's time for dealers to be held responsible for contracts that they make with growers and supply them with some tools to receive what is due for their hard work. It is time for this industry to share the risk of production that is currently only held by growers. It's time for growers to say, we've been taken advantage of long enough. It is time for this industry in Oregon to grow up. Some dealers and growers alike have made some bad decisions in the last few years. Some for reasons of intimidation, and some for reasons of desperation. But these bills are a beginning to building a fair and balanced approach to the seed capital of the world. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Just one
Senator
real quick.
Yeah.
So that seed that you put in the ground that you didn't get paid on, and then you didn't know that you harvested another year's crop. So how long does that crop stay in the ground generally? I mean, how many years is it good before you plow it under and you plant something new?
Typically, most contracts on a tall fescue are written for 3 years. Oftentimes, there's extensions to those contracts, so we might leave them in 5 years. You might leave them 7 years. I know guys have left them in 10 years.
As long as you have a good relationship with the...
Exactly.
On both sides, you can kind of just keep going.
Typically, the initial contracts are 3 to 4 year contracts with extensions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you,
Senator
sir.
Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you comment on the case that you make is compelling. What I'm trying to understand is what is unique about this market that makes it so that the market mechanism isn't working to correct things. I mean, it's been my experience that growers, people in agriculture, people in the timber industry where I come from, mm-hmm. tend to be fairly market-oriented people, and the less government regulation of a market, the better. And yet we have growers here before us asking us to establish some sideboards. And so what is it about this market that makes it so that if there is an abusive dealer, that growers, that other dealers aren't coming in and really using that as an opportunity to expand their market share by offering more favorable terms or whatnot?
One thing, let me start off with, sir, the fact that, we've got a limited amount of land. And oftentimes we don't have a whole lot of opportunities of what crops to grow, especially South Valley. They're really limited to grass seed because of the wet soils and some of those kind of things. So grass seed is kind of the option, at least at this point. So when we say we don't want government intervention, that's true. And there are guys that can grow varieties that are not specific to a seed company. They're open varieties. And we call those, they can play the market. And there are a number of those kind of growers that would plant an open variety that doesn't belong to a seed company, and they can sell it to whoever or whomever they would like. Or there may be some partnerships with a seed company where they would say, well, let's just kind of play the market. And that's fine. Typically, though my perspective is I would rather have a home for that stuff before I plant it. I want to know who I'm dealing with, where it's going, and when I'm going to get paid. I can take that to the bank. If I'm just playing the market, I've got to be willing and have the deep enough pockets to be able to carry that seed if it's not, you know, if it's not a marketable matter. As far as the parameters, why we want to do this, a lot of situations have come through over time. This has not happened overnight. Let's put it that way. For many years, it was on a handshake and away we go. Typically, though, as you know, in most any industry, when somebody gets into a financial situation, you're going to try to wiggle every way to make it work. And I think that's where we have come through in 2008 and 2009. So we're just trying to balance some of that. The fact that growers have taken on this much risk, and not to say that dealers don't have any risk, but we are the ones that have all the front money in that crop. If that addresses your.
Thank you, Ron.
Bill? Chairman Beyer and committee members, my name is Bill Merrigan. I'm from the Grand Area, Union County. I'm representing Blue Mountain Seeds and the Union County Seed Growers. I'm the general manager of Blue Mountain Seeds, which is in Union County. Blue Mountain Seeds is a grower-owned seed production company that was founded in 1967. We negotiate contracts with other seed dealers, and then in turn subcontract that production out to our local growers. I'm also a member of the Union County Seed Growers Association, which was incorporated in 1946. The first recorded seed production in Union County was in 1919. We began growing grass seed in the early 1930s. Seed production has been a vital part of production agriculture in Union County for the last 80 years. We feel that increased regulation on seed dealers in Oregon is ultimately going to cause those seed dealers to look outside the state for seed production opportunities, which would be very difficult on our growers and our economy in Union County. Therefore, I urge you to vote against Senate Bill 788. This bill is unnecessary and has no support from Union County. I also urge you to vote against Senate Bill 789. And while it's true other states have bonding requirements on seed dealers, in Oregon we have a slow pay, no pay law that works to protect growers. And the House Bill 2159 helped strengthen that law and has brought industry support. Bonding is an additional expense to businesses in Oregon that are already struggling, and those dollars are going to leave the state when I think we can least afford that to happen. Lastly, I urge you to vote against Senate Bill 790 as it's currently written. While we have no problem with the default contract when there no contract is provided, we do oppose any mandatory language in the bill, and especially the final payment date. And while I firmly believe any contract should have a final payment date, and I would never write one or sign one that didn't have one, I think that putting that in statute is a disadvantage to growers. Our growers deal with very unpredictable markets and are forced to use income averaging many years. One of the tools they use, I think that was alluded to today, is income deferral. By having that final payment date in statute, that kind of casts a cloud over a grower's ability to defer income. In closing, I'd like to thank you for your time and certainly be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Is there questions? There are none. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Katie Fast and Matt Crocker. Crocker? Be Matt.
I'm Matt Crocker.
Crocker.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Committee members. My name is Matt Crocker. I'm president of the Oregon Grass Seed Bargaining Association, third generation grass seed producer in Monroe, Oregon. I contract with some of the seed companies represented here today. I plant my grass seed in August or September of any particular year and harvest it 12 months later. I nurture this seed throughout the year, making many inputs, time, labor, monetary. And at harvest time, I bring that seed in and condition it for sale. I run it through the cleaning machines, package that seed in the container the seed company wants it in. I'm making it ready for sale. At that point, my part is done. I've grown the seed, I've cleaned the seed, I've packaged the seed. I am no longer in control of this seed. My obligation is finished at this point. The seed companies have not been taking responsibility for the crop like they should. Once a seed is conditioned and my part is done, the seed company at this time should pick up the seed, or if they wish, pay me to store the seed for a short period of time. They need to have this addressed in the contract. I'm not in the business of storage. I farm, and my crop should be moved to market or to a long-term storage facility of the dealer's choice. They can pay for storage. It is their seed, their variety. I can't sell it anywhere else. The growers here in the Willamette Valley have been getting taken advantage of with the dealers not taking delivery of the seed. It just gets left in our barn. They asked us to grow it, and then they leave it in our barn waiting until they need it. By them not taking delivery of the seed, I'm stuck with storing the seed for them. No terms in the contract address this. If I'm lucky, they will pay a storage bill. Many times a storage bill sent to them is simply ignored. If they want the seed bad enough, they will pay the storage when we refuse to load the truck until the storage is paid. This isn't right. We have another problem that hasn't been dealt with adequately. It's off-quality seed. This seed, having been protected with a Plant Variety Protection Act and is leased or owned by the dealers, I'm not allowed to do anything else with it. When this seed's off-quality, it may have a particular undesirable weed that prevents it from being used in the market it was intended for. We may have to sit on it for a year or more. Off quality sits around at the grower's expense until a dealer can sell his brand. Many times the grower will ask the dealer to release this seed so we can sell somewhere else. The dealer can, but many times won't. And we're stuck with that seed that we can't sell anywhere else. Again, we are at the mercy of the dealer. The ideas in these bills aren't new. They have been around the industry for a long time. We are bringing them forward. It's time for the industry to grow up a little and get the guys responsible for the contracts they place. Oregon values open space and industry provides much of that in Willamette Valley. We are asking today that you help us make it profitable so we can continue to provide it in the future. It is time for some adult supervision in our industry to make the dealers play on the same field with the same set of rules. Dealers who take the greatest advantage of growers and ride on a grower's credit line the longest undercut the good ethical dealers in the marketplace because they can sell for a lower price. This is driving all the dealers to have to adopt the same type of practices just to compete. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 790, 789, and 788.
Thank you, Matt. Questions? Katie?
Thank you. Good afternoon, and for the record, Katie Sash with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I am going to go quickly through the four pieces of legislation because you have a room, or actually two rooms of farmers today here wanting to testify. And the Oregon Farm Bureau has worked with the Bargaining Association, and they have incorporated many of our comments and thoughts on 790 and 789 into the amendments. On 790, we support the Dash 5 amendments, and we believe this version contains appropriate definitions and the referencing of the Uniform Commercial Code to determine pricing improves this bill. We also are in support of the Dash 1 amendments on 789. They provide some confidentiality language for dealers that we believe are important in keeping their information they submit to the Department of Agriculture private. We have not had the ability yet to vet the amendments that Mr. Beyer presented from the Oregon Seed Council. We'll hopefully be able to do that this week and see exactly where we are on his changes as well. In regards to Senate Bill 788, the Farm Bureau has concerns with the bill as drafted. The legislation does, as Mr. Simmons referenced, and accreditates bargaining associations that negotiate price. Also, the bill references bargaining associations that sell members and non-members seed, which the Oregon Grass Seed Bargaining Association does not at this time. We would ask that that sales language that falls in the bill several times be amended out. There are some concerns that some cooperatives that operate in the state currently might fall under those provisions and then have to be reporting members and non-members information to the Department of Agriculture. On House Bill 2159, we are in support of that piece of legislation and supported it in the House, which it moved swiftly to this committee, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
Senator Gerard? Real quickly, Katie, is there an overlap between 2159 and 790 that has to be addressed?
Vice Chair Atkinson, Senator Gerard, I think the overlap would just be in the rulemaking process, not in terms of the two bills. And the Department of Agriculture is going to be going forward in rulemaking around 2159. It can also incorporate in its rulemaking process the changes in 790. If 790 moves forward, it will definitely change how slow pay, no pay is administered in the state. And I think that's the reason why we're seeing this legislation or this series of legislation move forward is growers learn that the protections they thought were there for them under the slow pay, no pay that the legislature passed about 10 years ago, they found in these past few years that those protections weren't there when they went to try to make some pressure to get paid by May 1st or sometime in that range. Then they learned that their contracts could not withhold under slow pay, no pay, and that's why you're seeing these other pieces of legislation move forward.
Other questions? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Call forward Mr. Bill Dunn and Mr. Larry Dean. Mr. Dean, I think, is in the overflow. So wait for Mr. Dunn, if you'd like to begin, go ahead.
Well, there's supposed to be a packet of information, but that might be in the overflow as well. Thank you, Vice Chair Atkinson. I'm Bill Dunn, and I am the Executive Vice President of Seed Research of Oregon, based in Corvallis, Oregon. And I'm also honored to be the President of the Oregon Seed Trade Association. The OSTA is a representative. It's a group that represents 42 dealers, seed companies in Oregon. And as noted, we have a divided house here. We have some dealers that are members of the OSTA in support of these bills, but the majority of the membership is strongly opposed to 788, 789, and 790. We do support and have worked for 15 months on the vetting and the wording with the 2159, and we strongly support that and think that that is a new law in addition to the what the packet will show on the very top of the packet that will be handed out to you is the number of laws that are in Oregon in place to protect growers. And there's currently six, and this 2159 will become the seventh. And so we think that that process is the process that should be formed and followed. And today there's several references to amendments-2 or, as Mark mentioned, version 5, I think. And the first version we saw was January 14th. And then Mark introduced it to the group at large on January 18th. So the thing, in terms of the language, it keeps moving around. Now, the divided house extends even to the Oregon Seed Council. The OSTA has four seats on that council. We have four votes. Last Tuesday, when the Oregon Seed Council voted to support 790, the vote was 10-9. And when they voted to support 789, it was 10-8. The OSTA sided on both of the losing sides of that, but clearly it was a very close vote even there. The way we see the seed industry is really a combination. We need both parties. The dealers, seed companies absolutely need the products and the relationship with the growers. And I'm in a position here as a company manager where I'm in opposition to the bill for several reasons, but I still respect, honor, and abide by our contracts with the growers, because without them, our industry can't go forward. When you look at the way these things have evolved over the last 40 years in terms of the value creation between grower and seed company, this has led the seed industry to be one of the top five agricultural segments of the Oregon agriculture. Right, the 2009 data shows that it was ranked number four, $322 million. And 2009 was a particularly bad year for growers and dealers alike. In 2008, and actually in the fall of 2008, we had a worldwide recession. And it followed just about everything having been planted already in the fall of 2008. So we had anticipation of a continued boom in the markets, a continued growth pattern that we had for 15 years. It's followed by an utter collapse worldwide. And so we had production going like this, a forecast of sales going up, and in fact we had a cliff. It went the other way. And every seed dealer in the Oregon was impacted by it, and consequently so were the growers. In 2009, we estimate that the inventory valuation write down to dealers was between $80 and $100 million. That's inventory that we took, often at 68 cents, and sold it in a 45 or a 50 cent market, times the incredible numbers that we were producing. So the bulk of the dealers, I think, and I respect the testimony, because we do have instances, and they're embarrassing instances, where you have these incidents that are really unsavory. But in 2009, the inventory write-down is conservatively between $80 and $100 million. Now, the growers also suffered. They couldn't pay their bills. They didn't get payment in time. It was a tremendous, tremendous shake in the industry. And it was affected really worldwide. We're still not really out of it. As one of the gentlemen before me testified, you know, we don't know if we'll get back to those levels that we had in 2007. But certainly things are starting to improve. Markets have recovered somewhat. The other thing that we've done as an industry, and again, the industry is both sides. The seed companies have invested in market development, in product development, in technology, and we've gone to the growers and they've invested with equipment and farming practice, state-of-the-art farming practices with the support of the Oregon State University, a very cooperative working Oregon Department of Ag, and together we've created this value in the valley, in the entire state, and it's an incredibly important piece of our business. We think that to have legislation that to add four bills, not one, but four to the six that are already there, it's really very risky. So we urge you that you not support 789, 788, or 790.
Thank you.
Larry?
Mr. D, you're up.
Thank you, Senator Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Larry Dean, and I have a small seed company in Senator Beyer's district down in the Harrisburg area. I've been in the seed business as a marketer and a salesman to move seed to market since the mid-80s. I started my business, I got my business license, I think, in 2004. 2005 was my first fiscal year. We've been fortunate enough to continue through the downturn. In the last 3 years, we've added three employees. We have a total of four now. And we've doubled our volume in seed move to market. I would say our dollar volume, though, has remained the same the last couple of years because of the change in seed prices. So it's been a struggle. We've had a lot of burdens, but we're growing. And I am really concerned about all three of these bills. They place an additional burden on my business that's going to be hard to bear. In the interest of brevity, I'll just make a few comments about 789, but my comments will kind of represent the concerns I have about all three of these bills, and then a couple of general comments. 789 to bring a bonding could easily cost me several thousand dollars a year. Not all of our fiscal years have been profitable. Some of them have had a loss. Some of them we've barely squeezed by, but we've continued to grow. So I've been happy with that. Another burden of several thousand dollars a year is something I don't want to carry, of course. And I believe for smaller seed companies like me is a burden that we should not carry. I really question what this bonding bill would do in actuality. I noticed that Mr. Simmons, who represents most of the really strong proponents of this legislation, said that they're only going after the bad apples. I don't like competing with bad apples, but if I pay for a bond and there's one claim against that bond, immediately my bond, if I can stay in business, my bond costs go way up. And they're probably, since this industry has not been bonded in the past, is probably going to go up for the rest of the seed dealers as well. On top of that, since the bond only represents 6 to 10% of purchases a year that a dealer does with growers, let's say the claim of the bond went against him in the spring of the year and he owed 60% of his annual volume. We asked the Department of Ag what would happen. Would the one grower that was overdue payment on contract get collect on the bond and the other growers wouldn't? And my understanding from the Department of Ag is no, we would have a rule where all of the bills that were due would be triggered. So now we have a risk. What happens if that company's in such trouble that they say, please pardon me? What happens if that company is in such trouble that they think, I'm not going to make it through this? You have a large percentage of growers now on a bill that intended to enforce payment that are not getting paid. I see all kinds of serious problems on these bills, mainly because I think they've been rushed through and we haven't considered all the consequences. The whole industry hasn't had time to debate and say, what happens if this happens? What happens if that happens? And the Oregon seed industry is really important to the Oregon economy. What I'm doing is important. And I think that if we're going to make these kind of basic changes, then we need to be very careful about the overall effect. There's bad apples. I agree with my colleague here that if you ask nearly all of the dealers, all of the growers in this industry, we need some fixes. But we don't want fixes that are going to have unintended purposes and set an environment that makes it harder to compete, harder to grow, and harder to thrive. I'm for the fixes. Sorry about that. That's my wife. So I urge you to...
Maybe you should get it.
Busted.
Who are you?
Did you pick up?
I urge you to consider carefully the long term. If these bills go forward, I'm going to be submitting a lot of testimony to the committee. What happens if this happens? What happens if that happens? I suspect that we can't get a genuine fix if we need fixes in the industry from one special interest group in the industry. Maybe we need the Department of Ag and some consultants to say, what is the best atmosphere we can set in Oregon to make this industry thrive? So I urge you to carefully consider this and look beyond. I know that Mr. Simmons says that in order to be a dealer, all you have to do is pay $400 in your dealer. I emphatically state that's not true. You have to have 20 years of good reputation for growers to even sell to you. It's taken me a long time to be a dealer in this industry, and it's an industry I want to protect, and I seriously believe these bills hurt the industry, not protect it. Thanks.
Thank you, John. Oops, excuse me. Senator Starr.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. I'm glad you're here. The question... I guess that's not really a question. I just want to make a statement. Unfortunately, what we do in this building too often is pass legislation that impacts everyone to target those few bad actors. And I come from the construction contracting world where I had to be licensed up the wazoo. I had to carry a bond. I mean, there was the regulations requirement on me as a good contractor wasn't because of me, it was because of the bad actors. And unfortunately, that's the reality of the world that we live in that we have to deal with. I would ask that y'all come to the table with some solutions to the problem so that we can get after the bad actors. That's the bottom line. I'm convinced that in my conversations with growers that there's some real problems here. And if these aren't the solutions, what are they? And I don't think we have time to spend another 18 months to try to figure out what the solutions are to get after the bad actors. Unfortunately, whatever we do is going to impact everyone, and that's just the reality of kind of the world that we live in. So that's more of a statement, I guess, than it is a question.
Can I comment on that, Senator Starr?
Very quickly.
Okay. Do we need legislation that is going to protect people from signing stupid contracts? If we do that in an industry, it becomes a less competitive industry, and those issues need to be considered on these bills also.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. I know we're running short on time. Could either of you comment, since you represent the dealer side of this equation, about the makeup of the industry? How many dealers are there? Hundreds, or there are five? And how many, what's the market share of kind of
within our organization?
The top couple?
We represent 42 seed dealers. There's 205 dealer licenses in the state, I believe, is the current number. Our membership ranges from two or three employees up to north of 100. I would say our typical membership would be anywhere from 10 to 20 employees. And I think that, we employ, when we added up our numbers, we employ somewhere between 850 and 1,000 people on a full-time basis. And then during the busy seasons of spring and fall, we use a lot of temporary labor as well. And I think, you know, within the 42, we probably, within the group we represent, it's about 95% of all the seed, turf and forage seed moves through the state, for sure.
But so follow up. Mm-hmm. So is there one company that has 60% of the market share that really is more of a price setter and everybody else is a price taker, or... I'm trying to understand.
No, I think in the retail market, there's a couple of dominant players. And then in the professional market, which is, the at least 50 or 60% of what's done, it's a very fractured group. When you look at the top 10, they all probably have a similar market share, plus or minus 5%, top 8 maybe. Okay. So it's not really, in the retail market, there's a couple of very large players.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Atkinson? Two quick questions for Mr. Dunn. You've just laid out an entirely different timeline than we heard from the previous testimony. And I've been just a simple country boy, but as I've been around it, there's two ways to kill a bill. One is to give it a fiscal, and the other one is to say it's a rush job. So, you know, my hackles are not up. I'm just curious. We heard prior testimony that said your organization back in 2009 discouraged legislation. Is that true?
I think I was not active in that. Even though I was on the board, I was not active in that in those discussions. I believe the effort was to focus on the 2159 bill and focus on getting that adjustments to the no pay slow pay, as opposed to the other initiatives that were forthcoming.
Another question, and I'll let you go. Do you think there's an imbalance between the smaller number of dealers and the large number of growers?
In terms of, what do you mean by imbalance?
In terms of setting contract price?
Actually, within Oregon, we have an Oregon Bargaining Council, which would be under the auspices of the Department of Ag, where dealers and growers come together to negotiate. Currently, they've only been able to come to an agreed-upon price on perennial ryegrass. The statute allows for annual ryegrass and tall fescue to be included in that. There are some real issues with that whole process in terms of conflict of interest at the table, which our organization did go to the Department of Ag to discuss, including meeting with the director. We've not been able to get some of those issues resolved.
So is that why you're opposed to 788?
788 would be, I think, would be empowering a small non-representative group, and we really don't have the bargaining. There is a bargaining process in the state of Oregon, but we just don't have all the kinks out of the current bill.
How long is it going to take to get the kinks out?
You know, the OSTA board went to meet with the Department of Ag, and they referred it to the Department of Justice. And my understanding was that they said it was too difficult for them to mitigate, that it just didn't go anywhere. And as far as the timeline, I understand your concern. I looked at the website on the OGSBA group and saw a discussion around different legislation. We did not see any legislation until January 14th.
So these issues just sprang up in January, first time you knew about them?
Yeah, and in any kind of detail, for sure.
More? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We're getting really short on time, and I've got a long list, so I'm going to ask people, if you've got written testimony rather than read it, if you would want to come up and just give it to the staff and just tell us where you're at in terms of supporting or opposing the bills. Take time, I guess, you need, but please be as quick as you can. Next on the list I have Eric Bowers, Ralph Fisher, and Nick Bowers. Whenever you're ready.
I'll get up my glasses first. First thing, I want to apologize, Senator Beyer, Chairman. I do have testimony to hand in, and I'm not a very good, or I don't type very well, and I didn't have my glasses on, so I spelled your name wrong right off the bat. But I do support Senate Bill 789 and 790 with the amendments that are proposed by the Seed Council. And the message that I want you to remember today, I won't go through my testimony, but the message I want you to remember today is the grass seed farmer has become the credit line for the grass seed dealers. That's the bottom line of this whole argument. Whichever side you're at, that's what's happening.
Thank you.
I'm Eric Bowers, Senator Beyer, committee.
This is my brother.
Yes, I support 789 and 790 also. Just a quick answer to Senator Atkins' question that he asked Mr. Dunn here a few minutes ago. Yes, in the winter of a year ago, we did discuss contracting legislation in the Oregon Seed Council Legislative Committee, and it's made up of dealers and growers both, and we beat our heads against the wall for 3 or 4 hours. Growers wanted some legislation similar to what 790 is, and dealers wanted nothing at all, and so basically we never got anything out of a committee, and we just got tired of meeting because we were wasting a lot of time. But the bonding thing... Like Senator Starr was saying, I mean, my father-in-law is a plumber. He has to have a bond. If you're a carpenter, you got to have a bond. I support 789, the bonding bill, as the seed council, with their seed council amendments, which none of these guys are going to have a bond unless they screw up. And they try to not pay somebody or whatever. The best thing about the bond, yeah, like Larry said a few minutes ago, it's not enough to, probably going to be 10 cents on the dollar to the growers. But the best thing about it is that dealer's not going to be back in business next week, next year, under a different name. In the past history, this been going on in the last 5 years. This has been going on since, I mean, I've heard my grandpa complain about it 40 years ago, my dad complained about it 20 years ago. These dealers have been doing this kind of stuff for years, not paying their bills, and there's no consequences. You know, all of a sudden they're not in business today as brand A, and they're in business tomorrow brand B. So I guess I'd encourage you to vote yes on 789 and 790.
Thank you.
Senator Beyer, my name is Ralph Fisher. I reside at P.O. Box 407, Sublimity, Oregon. I served, I've been a grower for a long time. I served in from February of 05 through December of 09 as executive director of the Oregon Grass Seed Bargaining Association, representing many of the growers here today. This is one of the issues when you talk to growers that's been on the forefront of discussions of we've had with our members as we've talked with them and worked with them as far as an organization for all this time. One of the things, if you know, the internet is a wonderful thing, and if you Google ag production contracts, you can find there's 2 million hits that you can look at on what there is on ag production contracts. So you can go look at what makes good ag production contracts. We heard a little bit today about slow pay, no pay. One of the issues with slow pay, no pay is if a company does not issue a grower a contract, then it's not enforceable by the ODA. So one of the things we're cleaning up is if you are a company, get a grower a contract and get it an enforceable contract, because so many times over the last several years the term mutually agreed has been the price mechanism. What happens if the dealer and the grower never mutually agree on a price? Then that contract is not enforceable by ODA. So this legislation addresses several of those points. As far as the bonding, you know, I guess I thought this would be the easiest one. As Eric said, you know, every industry there is a bond. I think the question was asked what it takes to be a bond. In every industry, the plumber, the electrician, in every construction industry, we do have a bond. If you look at the Oregon Ag Information Network, they do have a website that talks about grower production costs, and growers have about minimally $800 per acre in their crop. I think on that website it talks about the average grower is 1,200 acres, so the average grower has $1 million out in the crop, $960,000 if you take that. So, you know, growers have a lot of dollars tied up in their crop, and there's no way of knowing the financial stability of the company they're growing with unless we have a bond. So I think that's why it's fairly important. As I said, I served as executive director from 05 through December of 09, matter. And so one of the things when Mark took over from me, he asked me to lay the groundwork of what the seed industry looked like. And there's numerous seed organizations in the industry. And when you look at them, and when I laid it out for Mark, there's only one that does not have any dealer input, and that is the Grass Seed Bargaining Association. And I think that's why they came forward with this legislation. As to the discussion of when and where and how, in 2005 we had a fairly contentious bargaining council meeting, and at the conclusion of that meeting, the Director of Agriculture came out with three steps of what needed to be done to help the industry, to kind of a long-range strategy. And that was a data, a process, and a long-range plan, and the Director of Agriculture came out with that. The problem with that plan at that time was it was a voluntary effort on all parts, and sometimes voluntary efforts don't yield results. One of the things we did as a bargaining association is the OSTA has their active, has two membership types of status. They have an active membership and an associate membership. The bargaining association is an associate member of the Oregon Seed Trade Association. They've asked us to contribute money to their programs. And so because of that, we get minutes of their board meeting, and on April 9th, 2009, they have record in their minutes that they will meet and contact the association to work on this issue. And after that, we have not done that. They have not reached out. In numerous times at the seed council meetings in 2009, the discussion came up about legislation, and so we've just asked and tried to find ways to come to the table. And at the Oregon Seed Growers League, you know, it's a fairly broad program. They put on the program for the seed industry at the 2009 Seed Growers League. There was a program by Dave Leonard, attorney, that talked about growers' contracts and statutory rights, responding to why you own the farmer when you can own, or why own the farm when you can own the farmer. So, you know, in 2009, many of these same ideas were discussed at the Oregon Seed Growers League. So there's been numerous times when this issue has been debated on contracts and bonding, and now the bargaining association brought those to the legislative level. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen.
Can I ask a quick question?
Senator Giroux.
This is for all three of you. 789 and 790 seem to be popular with all three of you. 788 is missing in the conversation. So did you do not support 788, or what's your feeling on Senate Bill 788?
I'm neutral on 788. I don't grow any of the... I guess I'm just neutral on it. Let's go say that.
Senator, I'm also in my brother's situation. I do not grow any of the products that are represented by the bargaining association, so I don't have an opinion on that either.
As a past executive director of the bargaining association, I support 788. I think what we've had is we've had growers that have transferred their ability to the bargaining association to negotiate price, but if a company doesn't come to the table in good faith to bargain, then how do we enforce that price that the grower has given us the ability to negotiate for? So I think in that, 788 does that. So
thank you, gentlemen. Gary, let's see, Betty Margot, Gary Vector, and Brenda Kirsch. And again, I'd ask you to be to the point in brief. I'm going to lose committee members here any minute. I've already lost one. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I've submitted written testimony, so I'm going to run through my cheat sheet as fast as I can for you.
Great, thank you.
The bottom line is...
And you put your name in record, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Gary Vochter. My wife and I farm in the St. Paul area. We've farmed since 1982, and we're members of the Grass Seed Bargaining Association. You can see the concern of a lot of growers here. Nobody wants more legislation, but it's come to the point growers cannot handle what we've been putting up with for the last probably at least 10 years, I'm going to say. The comment I've had a comment on is the seed dealer that was sitting here earlier. He said you can't keep farmers from signing stupid contracts. We don't sign stupid contracts. We sign contracts that a lot of companies just plain don't honor. The terms are there, but when it comes to settling, if it doesn't fit them financially, they work out policies for themselves, cleaning schedules that delay payments to growers. An example for us is, if you guys help you put your arms around this, one company we have is they set up a cleaning schedule. They don't want the seed till April after we harvest. We harvest in July and August. This one company's policy has resulted in us not receiving any crop payment for the year 2010 that's grown for this company. This value is over $100,000. Okay, by the time we receive any money from this company, we've paid to finance the 2010 crop, plus we've started putting money into our 2011 crop since approximately last September. So we're going to be financing one full crop, 80% approximately of another crop, before we're going to receive any money. That's not fair. The three other companies that we grow for, we're paid up approximately 80%. And by the way, they're the three companies that are supporting these bills. So you can see there's a balance of responsibility some companies are taking, and others just avoid. What they have to do is, the sad part is that some of it is driven because they're corporate companies, and their stockholders basically come before us. They got to show profit to the stockholders, and however they treat their vendors, it doesn't matter. Some dealers, what they've done is they've extended their terms to their vendors. Say they're selling to Home Depot or whatever. Well, instead of saying we want payment in 30 days, they'll extend it to 60, 90, whatever days. And then they come back to us and they'll say, well, so they put those repercussions of lack of cash flow onto the growers. That's got to stop. We have to pay our bills. We pay our fertilizer, our chemical bills, parts, 30 days after we buy them. Why shouldn't a seed company, after they get a good test, why shouldn't they have to do that? Dealers need to take responsibility ownership. They make it very clear in their contracts. They own the seed stock that we plant. They own the plants in the field. They own the seed that we produce. The grower's sole responsibility is to reproduce the seed that they want. I'm just going to make it quick. I support Senate Bill 790. We just need contracts that the Department of Ag will be able to use in case there's a non-payment. They can use it. Right now they can't. Mr. Simmons made that point. It's sad. Senate Bill 789, the reason we need bonding, this is an example, is we had a seed company that we grew crop for in 2009. Came to June, they said, we can't pay you. The reason they couldn't pay us is because they could not secure a loan from the bank unless they had a sales contract that they could take to their bank. So we carried them. We didn't have a choice. We carried them till that fall. We got paid in November. The agreement was that we were going to get a little carrying charge. We didn't get that. At the point, sometimes that's what growers end up with, is you're happy to get paid because you get threats of, you know, I mean, you take it or leave it. It's a very troubled area in our industry. We need Senate Bill 789. We need it to assure growers and their lending institutions that the companies they are contracting with have the ability to secure financial backing to match their production commitments. I think that's fair. Nobody carries that. So we pay our bills or you don't. I mean, if you don't, you're either going to not get buy fertilizer or you're going to get charged interest. So I support that bill also. 788, dealers need to come to the table too. It's ridiculous. They have a great opportunity in Oregon because there's a law that allows them to come and meet. Otherwise, they're in violation of antitrust. And what blows me away is they don't use that opportunity. They have that. What they do, though, is they'll use that and they'll say, well, we didn't participate. We're not bound by the agreed price that the bargaining has set. It's not right. This bill would be good for our industry because it would create good dialogue between growers and dealers. The information could be shared for better understanding of each party's costs and the commitments and the market conditions and the potential. So I think Senate Bill 788 is good also. We need to strengthen this industry. It's really sad. It's really in a sad state where there's no integrity left on a lot of companies and their business ethics. If I was in this room representing some of these companies, I would be embarrassed. They should be embarrassed. It's really sad.
Thank you.
So, and I hope my written testimony will explain it better to you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Whoever wants to go next.
Go ahead. Okay. Good afternoon, Senator Beyer, Chairman Beyer, excuse me, and members of the committee. My name is Betty Margit. My husband and I are farmers in the South Willamette Valley. My family has been farming for over six generations. My father and grandfather came over the pass from Bend in a wagon train, if you can believe that. So we've been around a long time and done a lot of farming, and we enjoy it. We do not enjoy what's going on today, and it has been extremely difficult in the atmosphere that we're dealing with some dealers. We need dealers. We're good at what we do, at growing grass seed and other crops, but we need the dealers, and we have partnerships. We're lucky to have partnerships with some very good dealers that are in the audience today, and we enjoy that relationship. We respect it because they respect us. We also deal with some companies that are quite the opposite, and people will always ask, why do you deal with those people? Well, once you sign a perennial contract that lasts 3, 5, 7 years, it's tough to get out of it. And once they start diminishing the way that they do business, we're stuck. We really are stuck. So I do support all three legislation, 788, 789, and 790. They are perfect compartmentalized match to resolve some of the problems we have today. And I think you will understand that we have a problem in this industry. And it is a very good thing when our industry comes together and the group that drafted this bill, these bills, are from dealers, growers, and bankers, and ODA, I think, has helped, and legal counsel. And that's the very best way to fix this situation. We've tried to get the dealers to resolve these problems for years. They will not do anything. They are taking advantage of just their poor performance. So it is my sincere hope, and I'm going to be real quick, that you will consider this. We do not own the seed. If you take home nothing today, please understand that they own all the rights to that seed the moment it's put in the ground. We have no rights. The only thing we want is to be paid for them. And because we do have some really good seed companies out there, they cannot compete on a level playing field when you've got some really poor performing companies that are undermining the market on a constant basis. they're able to sell product cheaper, and it keeps driving down the price. Now, we've been lectured by bankers, by legal counsel, and lots of people in the industry that we need good contracts, and we're not good business people. Well, here we are. We're here before you today to make a case that we are trying to clean up this industry and be good business people. And that's simply what it's about. We want to be paid, and if we can get rid of some of the bad companies, we'll all be better off. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chairman Beyer and committee members. My name is Brenda Kirsch, and I'm a third-generation farmer from St. Paul, Oregon. I come before you today, I do have written testimony as well, and so I'll kind of summarize what that is. It's basically two examples of why I think this legislation is so important. The first is discusses we put in about 120 acres of perennial ryegrass for seed for a company that we have been growing for over 15 years. We did not have a contract in hand. We did ask for it repeatedly when we put it in. A few months later, we got the contract, and it was drastically changed. The terms were actually 60 days later. We originally had contracts of May 1st payment, and when we got it, it was July 1st. When we went to them, you know, they just kind of looked at us and said, well, the seed's in the ground, and these are our contracts now from here forward. We didn't have anything to go against that. We had nothing. So we're sitting here today asking you to help us to please encourage those contracts to come out earlier with the date of May 1st. It's 10 months after the seed is harvested. I don't think that it's good business to have to wait an entire year to get your seed cleaned. Also, I'd like to tell you that in the fall of the economy, it was a hard time on everyone. And as farmers, we did understand that. And we did work with our companies, as Gary mentioned, to hold those companies and carry them afloat through the years. And we're still paying the interest off on a lot of our loans through that time. So I would ask you to please allow us to get out of that financing the seed companies and get back to getting paid for what we're producing for them. And I would ask you to please support 789 and 790. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, all of you. Let's see here. Mike Baker, John Elbert, and that finishes that list, and Troy Hadley. Gentlemen, please be quick if you can.
Okay, I'll go ahead then, Senator Beyer. Thank you, and members of the committee. I'm Mike Baker. I'm the Senior Vice President and General Manager of Pennington Seed. We're located in Lebanon in Linn County in Oregon. I manage the largest turfgrass seed research facility in North America, the largest production base of certified grass seed in Oregon, and one of the largest seed production, manufacturing, packaging, and shipping facilities in North America. But I had small beginnings on Priceboro Road in southern Linn County. And in 1985, I was asked to help build a company from very meager beginnings. And today, Pennington Seed has over 100 employees in Oregon working in research, production, packaging, shipping, and sales. In addition to shipping to every state in the U.S. via our customers that include Costco, Lowe's, Home Depot, and Walmart, we export Oregon-grown seed to over 60 countries throughout the world. We purchase over $50 million in seed each year, most of it through seed production contracts that we've been discussing here today. Over 80% of our seed is produced in Oregon from Washington, Lane, Jefferson, and Union County, and most of the counties in between. I've been involved with the development of Senate Bill 789 and 790 over the past year. I support Senate Bill 789 because purchasing seed from a grower requires financial responsibility. The ability to pay for products purchased on a seed purchase or production contract is a necessary part of creating a free market where participants are on an equal footing. Under the current practice, no requirement for financial responsibility is required. The current practice allows seed dealers to contract for seed and then delay payment or refuse payment due to market conditions, such as the normal boom and bust cycles that are typical of agriculture. This puts a sound financial company like Pennington Seed at a big competitive disadvantage, as growers expect us to pay for the seed that is contracted. Senate Bill 789 requires a seed dealer to post a very modest bond relative to the purchases from Oregon farmers. I support this bill as an appropriate measure to ensure that only companies with sound finances trade in seed production contracts and purchases from Oregon farmers. I also support Senate Bill 790 because seed companies should only contract for seed that can be marketed in a timely manner. Payment of contracted seed by May 1 of the year following harvest should be plenty of time to make payment. If no final payment date is specified, seed dealers are able to avoid the responsibility for final payment of seed. In this environment, seed dealers are free to speculate on the backs of growers and contract for more seed than they can hope to sell because they would like to gamble, and if a shortage occurs, they can take advantage of the market. Either way, in the current situation, a seed dealer gives the grower no promise of a final payment date and has many delay tactics available to put off financial responsibility. I believe Senate Bill 790 corrects this problem by requiring clearer terms and a final payment date for contracted seed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sir.
Senators, my name is John Albert. I'm a practicing lawyer here in Salem. I have been so for 30 years. I'm also, since about 2007, I've been the counsel for the Grass Seed Bargaining Association. My practice for that 30 years has consisted almost primarily of what I'll call agricultural finance, and I've represented farm lenders, suppliers of chemical and fertilizers. I've represented farm landlords, and I've represented farmers. I'm also a bankruptcy lawyer, so a lot of this work has taken place in bankruptcy court, and I'm sorry to tell you that business is brisk. I have read, in my professional duties, I have read countless grass seed contracts over the last 15 years. And I want to share with you three observations about them and the trends that I've seen in them. And these three things, I think, are at the heart of the debate we're having here today. The first is that these production contracts are almost exclusively what we lawyers call open price contracts. The price isn't fixed. It may vary from year to year. Now, there's nothing immoral or illegal about that. That's a common thing in commerce. And it's dealt with in the sale of goods under ORS Chapter 72, which is a comprehensive piece of legislation covering sale of goods. But as the witnesses have told you, these grass seed production contracts are not contracts for the sale of goods. They are production contracts. You can't sell what you don't own. So there's serious question about whether any of these provisions of Article 2, which is of the Commercial Code, which is ORS Chapter 72, serious issues about whether those apply to grass seed production contracts. And the Department of Agriculture, in its duties in enforcing the no-pay, slow-pay law, has taken the position that these open-price contracts are unenforceable. And that's a heck of a thing to produce the crop. Go to the department to avail yourself of the remedy that's supposed to be there for you, and then be told, sorry, you've got an unenforceable contract. Senate Bill 790 fixes that by declaring that these contracts are enforceable and incorporating, by reference, the provisions that from Chapter 72 that make them enforceable. The second thing I've noticed about grass seed contracts is that they are almost never signed before the crop is planted. And I began to notice this as I was reviewing these contracts. And I've asked farmers why that was. And universally, the answer is that they did not receive a written contract from the company for some 3 to 6 months after the crop has been planted. And I see that as a serious problem. How can you say that there's freedom of contract in this business when the grower doesn't see the contract for 3 to 6 months? When he finally sees it, it's really too late to negotiate the terms. At that point, the farmer has committed his land, his labor, his capital, and his credit. He is all in. It is too late for him to plow it out. that problem is even more magnified when you consider that these are long-term contracts, and it takes a year or two for the farmer to recoup his costs. He's all in at that point, and bargaining is difficult. The two parties, the grower and the dealer, are simply not in an equal bargaining position at that point. I did some research around the laws of other jurisdictions, and I was surprised to find that, for example, in Minnesota, there's a law that requires, it's not limited to seed production, but it requires the companies to provide the contracts to the farmers 90 days before the crop is planted. I think Senate Bill, by contrast, Senate Bill 790, by simply providing certain mandatory terms applicable to all contracts and some additional default terms that apply when the contract doesn't get signed before the crop is planted, is quite modest by comparison. The third thing I've seen about these contracts is that payment for the crop, for the production, keeps getting pushed further and further and further back. When I first started representing farmlenders, it was my observation that these crops were paid for in the fall, after harvest. Then it became half in the fall and half in the spring. Now we're sitting here having a debate about whether May 1 of the calendar year following harvest should be a firm deadline or not. To people who do business with the farmers by extending credit, by extending fertilizer and inputs on credit, they find it almost incomprehensible that we're having this discussion about May 1. Their view would be that farmers should be paid when they produce the crop. And you've heard how this legislation will address that problem. I lastly want to share with you a story about a grass seed farmer that's in bankruptcy right now, just about to emerge. I asked this farmer why she continued to grow this crop. Why not change, grow something else? And she gave me an interesting answer. She said, you need to understand two things. First of all, these contracts are multi-year contracts, and it's not so easy to get out of them. But the second thing she told me was that not only is their land typically uniquely suited for this kind of production, and often only suited for that kind of production, a grass seed farmer has put a tremendous investment into the infrastructure in the nature of equipment, sometimes including seed cleaning equipment. They can't stop on a dime and decide to grow cauliflower. They're all in. They've made that investment, and they need the help that these bills would represent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please.
I'll keep it short. My name's Troy Hadley. I'm a fifth-generation farmer up in the Silverton Hills. I've been here talking about field burning in the past. I'm not going to go over what everybody else has said, but basically the two things, I've sat on the Farm Bureau Committee that looked at these bills, and I've been on the Legislative Committee in the past and worked on the stuff last year. And what happened in the Legislative Committee for the Oregon Seed Council last year, it's like Eric Bauer said, we came in there as a representative for growers. We wanted to come up with some contract terms to put in the legislation with the Seed Council's support, and they basically stonewalled us and sat there and said, just argued and argued. We finally gave up, get what we had, and we'll work on this later. Well, it's later. And this is what and another group came up with it. I am in full support of 789 and 790. 788 was directly pulled from, I believe it directly pulled from Minnesota. I'm not positive on that. But I think it needs a little bit of work on it. And my recommendation, personal recommendation, is the work group oversight cited by ODA to come up with a proper way to get accreditation. I believe growers need to have the ability to bargain, and the dealers should be forced to bargain with representation. But there may be room for work on 788. And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Troy. Questions? Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. The next panel is George Pug, Terry Stalford, and Brent Bolton.
Almost there.
Getting close.
My name is Harry Salford. I'm from Tangent, Oregon area in Linn County. I farm approximately 5,000 acres of grass seed. I've been involved in many contract productions, which has gone both ways. And I'm going to defer all my testimony today because I have some written testimony that I'll submit.
Thank you very much.
You bet. One more thing, though, sir, Senator, is I'm not a member of the bargaining association, and I would like for you to realize that there's a lot of growers that are not members of this association, so this is not 100% grower supported.
Okay.
None of these bills are.
Okay.
Chair Beyer, committee members, my name is George Pugh. I'm a farmer. I'm here representing our family seed farm, Pugh Seed Farm from Shedd, Oregon. And I'm also representing our wholly owned seed company, Ampac Seed Company at Tangent. My personal philosophy leans against a continual expansion of law into our lives and businesses. I believe that current civil law, if applied by the growers, would curb the occasional abuse of seed production contracts. When I graduated from high school about 50 years ago, I was told that farming would become a business. It has, and it's about time that we all realize that responsibilities of being a businessman involves reading your contracts and not signing or activating them until you're comfortable with what they say. These contracts are individual contracts, and it is a negotiating thing. You can alter them and bargain with a company, but you have to make the point to do it. And then if you have a trouble with the contract, the farmer should be taking on the offending company in court. I hear that that's not possible. Currently in Washington, some people have gone against one of the largest seed companies in the United States and won first round in court. So really, I'm a little disappointed that we as farmers have not been more proactive in pursuing bad actors in the business. However, Senate Bill 790, as I understand it, from March 22nd, which was until today the last edition I'd see, added ambiguity to the contracting process. And we already have overworked attorneys, and I feel it kind of who would probably exploit it anyway. Senate Bill 789, as of March 22nd, by use of tiered bonding schedule in the bonding part, it unfairly, I think, impacts smaller seed companies over larger ones, and I'd like to see that also change. Now, pardon me. Now, I think from my above comments, you have probably picked up on the idea that I don't really favor this legislation. That being said, I understand that the Oregon Seed Council has proposed a series of amendments, and I believe they were read to mentioned to you earlier, and have proposed a series of amendments and have based their support, the Seed Council has based their support on the inclusion of those amendments. Having represented at times either the Oregon Ryegrass Seed Growers Commission or the Oregon Tall Fescue Commission on the Oregon Seed Council, and having at one time been president of the Oregon Seed Council, I recognize the Oregon Seed Council as the umbrella for action and a legitimate voice of the Oregon seed industry. While I might have voted differently than the majority when the OSC staked out their position, I nevertheless support their position on these two legislative measures as long as they include the OSC's amendments in their entirety. Since the Oregon Seed Council took no position on Senate Bill 788, I would like to express my opposition to the bill unless subsection 3 of section 3 is amended, and testimony that I've handed in, you'll see it in bold type. I would like to have amended to say a perennial ryegrass, annual ryegrass seed, or tall fescue seed dealer that seeks to buy perennial ryegrass seed, annual ryegrass seed, or tall fescue seed from the Seed Association. Currently, it just says seeds. I would like to retain for the ability of a seed company that if they chose not to be involved in the bargaining process by dealing with members of the bargaining association, would still be able to buy non-grass seed products or non-covered grass seed products from various farmers. My concern is that without this change, the seed company would not be able to purchase or contract for production with recognized bargaining association members for seed crops not involved in this act, i.e. clover, radish, point fescue, et cetera. I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, George.
Good afternoon, Chairman Beyer and committee members. Thanks for this opportunity. I know it's late, also I'll be brief. I also have a prepared statement, but I'd like to just go through it real quickly if I could, just so I could keep on point here.
Please.
My name is Brent Bolton. I'm the director of Global Grass Seed from the Scotts Company. So we're, along with Pennington, the big company in the room, I think. We also have a long history of grass seed production in Oregon, going back probably 75, 85 years now. The Scotts Company actually got its start in the Midwest in Ohio, and in the seed business by mail order over 100 years ago. So we have a long history in the seed business, and we too are very interested in the outcome of turfgrass seed production in Oregon. We're also proud of the fact that we successfully have right now, it ebbs and flows, about 150 growers that we have, for the most part, very good, strong relationships with. We have, in 2010, which was our lowest year in many years, we had 25,000 acres of production in Oregon, and it was about $22 million that we purchased in seed. So if you went back 2 years, that was about double of that, so almost $50 million in grass seed purchases in Oregon. We have 75 employees in Oregon, and now that's not just grass seed, that's across three different categories of business for us, because we also participate in many other lawn and garden categories. Regarding the Senate Bill 790 relating to agriculture seed contracting establishes production contracts between the seed producers and dealers. We are opposed to the original bill, Scotts is. We do feel legislation is necessary because we and other industry leaders already offer contracts to our growers. We feel that's good coverage and should stand the way that it is. However, we can live with amended changes with that bill. There have been, related to that, and the OSTA has discussed this a little bit, several amendments that have been circulating around on this one, 790. These significantly improve legislation and would enable us to take a neutral position on the bill. Though amendments still continue to be drafted this week, and we were just given one about an hour before we walked into the room, so we haven't really had an opportunity to vet it yet, but we would be neutral on the bill. 788 is relating to the accredited seed associations. The Scotts Company is opposed to this legislation, along with the ASPA and PSA, which haven't been mentioned as of yet. The Pacific Seed Association and the American Seed Trade Association have both come out in opposition to this bill. The bill creates a clear conflict of interest in the process for establishing the price of grass seed and a result of the composition of a credit association, including its unclear requirements, which we've talked about, I think, at length. That's always been a concern of the OSCA and other dealers that don't currently participate. With a singular bargaining source, seed dealers would be placed at an unfair disadvantage, while growers are not bound and can sell at any price. Next, forced participation would completely impede both seed dealers and producers' right to freedom of contract. This legislation is unnecessary and has potential to drive grass seed production to other states, and I think we've already seen some of that. So in closing, I strongly encourage the committee to evaluate four pieces of legislation, to evaluate if four pieces are needed to regulate seed industry. I think in one of my meetings with one of the senators, we discussed how long that the seed industry had been in Oregon, and I think it was pointed out that we 75 or 100 years and we didn't need this legislation. Why do we need it now? So currently we produce $22 million on a low year. We do not want these bills to hinder our freedom to operate in Oregon. So if you have any questions of me or now or in the future, I think you have my contact information.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay.
And let's see, we're getting near the end here. Steve Tubbs, Brett Freeborn, and I think it's Bruce McKay or McKee. Please.
Chairman Beyer, committee. My name is Steve Tubbs. I've had Turf Merchants Incorporated in Tangent, Oregon for 28 years. One of the last independent seed dealers. I think in that 28 years I've moved more than half a billion pounds of Oregon grass seed without much trouble. I came here to announce my displeasure in the bonding bill 789 because I think it's an unnecessary expense and doesn't really go far enough in protecting farmers. It would mean $7,000 to $10,000 a year for my company, probably industry-wide $300,000. But since I signed up to testify, I found out it's already been amended and there's a dash one, and that removes a lot of my objections. So we can further talk about that, but again, it changed by the time I sat down, so I won't waste your time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Steve. Hi, I'm Brett Freeborn. I represent Mountain View Seeds. Senator Beyer. We're a seed company that's located just east of Salem. Employ about 40 to 50 people throughout the year. We market a substantial volume of seed across the U.S., across the world. We are in support of Senate Bill 789 and 790. We believe these bills have been drafted to provide reasonable protection for growers with a very minimal impact on seed dealers that honor their contracts and their verbal commitments. We support 789, the dealer bonding bill. At this point in time, dealers need little financial ability to pay for the crops that they've contracted with growers. Seed dealers basically sell the grower seed, hope to get paid, then in turn try and pay the grower. This is why many of the dealers avoid taking ownership of their production unless they have actual sale for that product. We feel that Senate Bill 789 requires minimal assurance of financial responsibility on the part of the dealer. For a dealer with good credit that purchases around $20 million worth of seed annually from growers, the estimated cost on the proposed bond we figure is between $3,000 and $4,000 a year. In our opinion, this is pittance versus the financial obligation that seed dealers have to the growers. Just to put this in perspective for you, a seed dealer can go and for $40,000 or less can purchase a variety of grass seed, proprietary variety, and the seed stock that it would take to go and easily contract $3.5 million worth of obligations to growers over the course of a 3-year period, which most of these contracts are set up for. So at the end of the day, the dealer can go and pay $40,000 to get into the game with a variety and has $3.5 million worth of obligations. So we feel that this bill will provide a strong incentive for dealers to be responsible when it comes to contracting seed so they don't get their bond pulled. We also are in support of Senate Bill 790. That's the contracting bill. At this point, I know you've already heard about the slow pay, no pay rules, but in our opinion, the law is basically worthless at this point, and it will continue to be so even with the proposed legislation, the proposed changes in House Bill 2159. Basically, the problem is the majority of the contracts in Oregon are wrote where the price will be determined by the dealer or by mutual agreement. And as you've heard, those contracts are not enforceable by the Department of Ag. Because of these unenforceable contracts, it's our feelings that many dealers have walked away from their obligations, leaving growers highly leveraged, with few options other than accepting below market price for their seed. This cheap seed, in turn, is sold into the market, undercutting companies that have honored their contracts and paid fair prices. This practice has placed seed companies that have honored their contracts at a severe competitive disadvantage. We'd like to ask for your guys' support on 789 and 790.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Sir.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman Beyer. and Senators. My name is Bruce McKee. I'm a grass seed grower in Polk County, Yamhill County, and I will make my comments very brief and to the point. Since I've been involved in grass seed in about past 30 to 40 years, there's been three major downturns in the market, one in the 80s, one with agrobiotech in the late 90s, and then this current housing crisis that we've come across. And to be honest with you, with the seed companies that I've grown for in the past, there's only problems when there's a downturn and there's a glut of seed on the market. Mutually, we've always worked well together except for these small times. I personally have witnessed seed companies that have not honored their contract, and it typically goes something like this. I produce their seed, it's set in my warehouse, the contract may say payment 30 days after ship or price to be mutually agreed upon. Well, 12 months later, 18 months later, 24 months later, that seed still may be sitting in my warehouse. It has not been shipped. I have not been paid. Talking to the seed company, we may have a contract, and I'm trying to be brief here. We may have a contract that has a 40-cent minimum on it. The market has tanked. You'll get the phone call. It will say, hey, Bruce, I can move your seed. Price isn't 40 cents, but, you know, we can get that seed moved for 28 cents. Well, you know, a farmer sitting on the other side of the phone thinking, I need cash flow, tired of sitting on the seed, markets don't look favorable, you know, take my seed. I do realize if my seed doesn't go down the road, the next farm, my next door neighbor is going to get the same phone call. So, I mean, we do have a binding contract, we do have a legal contract, but it's just business. And, you know, you learn from the school of hard knocks. I don't deal with those companies anymore. They're not my top three or four companies that I even currently work with. But there still are a lot of contracts out there that way. So that's why I would urge you to support Senate Bill 790, just because it needs to be shored up a little bit. Briefly on Senate Bill 789, it's good legislation. I don't have a problem with it at all. I'm not paying the bill. You know, companies like Mr. Tubbs's is. Super quick story, again, from personal experience. Agrobiotech, late 90s. You may have heard about them. They were buying seed companies here in the Valley. I'd shipped them seed. Had not gotten paid 30 days after test. Trying to work with Agrobiotech, believe it or not, Senators, I shipped them more seed 10 days before bankruptcy was filed and all the doors were locked. I soon learned that possession is, you know, 90% of the law, because I couldn't get my seed back, though it was 5 miles down the road. And that instance did cost my family farm about $120,000. Again, good learning experience. But the companies I deal with now are reputable, and I am not at all worried about that. But I do think in that instance there would have been the canary in the coal mine. There would have been red flags going everywhere. So that's why I support Senate Bill 789 also. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I have one more person, Pat McLean. Sorry.
Well, I'm actually using two. Testimony already?
Oh, good. So you don't have to read it all.
But I do get to talk for a minute.
You do get to talk.
So, good afternoon, Chairman Beyer and committee members. My name is Pat McLean. I, along with my partner, Mick McGregor, own and operate a seed company in Polk County. I began in the seed business in 1985. I was hired by a gentleman named George Burlingham and the Burlingham family. You've talked about, or, you know, there's been talk today about the seed industry and how old it is. Burlingham is one of the oldest companies around. It was founded in 1911. And, you know, I've been brought up and raised on a lot of principles about a proprietary seed business and how they should be run. I am an Oregonian. I'm born and raised in Albany. I went to Oregon State. I got two kids there. I'm as Oregonian, I'm as ingrained in this industry as you will find anyone. And I'm the dealer. I'm the bad guy. at least that's what we're being portrayed as here. And I guess, you know, I halfway take offense to that, because we aren't the bad guys. We are the good guys. We've invested a substantial amount of money in our company. Mick and I have owned it since 2000. And, you know, you heard talk of Agri Biotech a minute ago. I was part of that. I worked for a company. I was the general manager of a company that got bought by Agri Biotech. I worked through that bankruptcy. You know, there was a lot of people that worked extremely, extremely hard to get these growers the money that they were paid, and they did get a huge amount of money out of that bankruptcy. At that point in time, you know, and that bankruptcy was the largest bankruptcy in the history of Nevada, and I was sitting right in the middle of it, and it was ugly. But what we got out of that was I learned a valuable lesson, and that is we have Oregon lien laws. Mr. Dunn talked about several other laws that are on the books in Oregon that already support the seed industry. There is protection for growers. What my testimony is actually about is 2159, and I've been, you know, I've been on the board of directors of the Oregon Seed Trade Association for the past year and a half, and I believe that the Oregon Seed Trade Association has been very proactive in everything that we're doing. Even today, I mean, we are sitting here today addressing you as an association that we care about our industry. 2159 has the broad support of the Seed Council, of the Oregon Seed Trade Association, the American Seed Trade Association, and the ODA. It was brought forth by the governor on behalf of the Oregon Department of Ag. It was brought forth to shore up the slow pay, no pay law that was brought into legislation in 2001 without any industry input. So all we're trying to do is fix that thing up, clean it up, so that it'll work for the industry. And 2159 addresses the slow pay, no pay. I believe you heard the, you know, ODA testify earlier about, you know, some of the changes that were specifically in that. And I, you know, in general, support 2159. It's thought out. It's a process that's been gone through with everybody. I think that's the direction that we need to go as an industry right now. And as an industry, I do not support 790, 788, or 789.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions of Pat? Thanks very much, Pat. And some things to read into the record.
Yeah, we had several people who couldn't attend today. Jerry Hall from Grassland, Oregon, submitted a letter. Larry Dean submitted a letter, and Niles Jensen submitted a letter for the record.
Thank you very much. That is all the people we had that signed up at great risk. Is there anybody else who feels a real need?
No.
Thank you very much. It was very enlightening for those of us who are not in your industry. The committee will have to consider this and probably talk with the department a little bit, and Mr. Simmons and Mr. Byer and others, and see how we go forward on these. So I appreciate your taking the time today. It's been a long day. So I'm going to I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 788, 789, 790, and House Bill 2159. For the record, I am carrying over Senate Bill 507. Let's see, Senate Bill 438, Senate Bill 518, Senate Bill 725, and Senate Bill 877. Committee, is there anything else for the business today? Seeing none, we are adjourned.